Okay, thank you all for coming. Welcome to the New Art Gallery Walsall to it's the Hawthorne exhibition, Movie Bodies. And I'm very, very pleased to have here Carol Jacoby, who's co-curated the exhibition with me. We've been working on this for a couple of years now, haven't we?
Yeah.
And it's been a fabulous experience, I must admit. Carol, however, is the expert on Isabel Hawthorne, having written a book, which is not published yet, but it will be soon. So it's called Out of the Cage, The Art of Isabel Hawthorne, and it'll be published next year by Yale University Press. So if you're really interested in her work, you know, do watch out for that. Carol is the curator at Tate Britain, and she's done an enormous amount of research, as you can imagine, over how many years on Isabel Hawthorne?
Yeah, about 6 years.
About 6 years. So I think now, once it's published, you're going to be moving on to other things.
If she'll let me.
Absolutely. Anyway, without any more ado, I shall hand you over to Carol, who's going to tell you all about Isabel.
Well, I just want to start off by thanking Jo for having the idea for the exhibition in the first place, and also for bringing a fresh eye to Isabel. So she had a very different view on her than I had, which was really very interesting for me. And I think I would also like to thank Biddy Noakes, the lender of the paintings, for all her work. And she's not here today, but I'm sure we'd all want to thank her. So I think if I was going to sort of sum up Isabel's career in one phrase, it would be as a life painter. And a life painter in sort of quite a broad sense, in that her basic, her main interest was in the body. And whether that was the body of animals or human beings, and just in the sort of way we exist. That's what interested her through her life. And this arose partly out of the sort of upheavals of the century in which she lived. And so what I'd like to do, first of all, is spend a little bit of time introducing you to Isabel and her career and as a person, and then I'll take you around the exhibition after that. I think the best thing is, if you have any questions, just interrupt me as I speak, or any comments, any suggestions even, interrupt me as I speak, because you know, if we leave it to the end, then you sort of forget what you were going to ask. So, okay, so Isabel was born in 1912, so that means that when she was two, her father was going off to World War I. And in fact, her father was home very little because he was a merchant seaman. And so Isabel and her mother led a very self-sufficient life. They sort of moved from port to port. And I think it's very important. Isabel was never prepared to relinquish that independence that she had as a child. Come on in and take a seat. So when she was 12, the family fetched up in Liverpool, and Isabel finally went to a proper school. But she still spent most of her time running wild, swimming in the sea at all times of the year, sketching the wildlife. Her father was an amateur naturalist, and she developed a scientific view on life from him, and the habit of drawing, collecting, drawing birds and animals from a very early age. And I think one of the really important aspects to remember with Isabel is that she was one of the first generations of women who weren't from the upper classes to have access to secondary education. She was also the first generation to have access to the radio, in that, you know, so therefore you didn't have to be able to afford to go to a concert to be able to hear classical music, for example. When Isabel was 16, in 1928, women got the vote. And a few weeks later, she actually put her name down and enrolled in Liverpool College of Art. Now, Liverpool College of Art is still going strong. The only other famous person that went there that I know of is John Lennon, and Isabel herself, of course. In these days, it was expected, any fine art job was expected to go to men, particularly veteran soldiers or DMOB soldiers. And if you were studying art as a woman, you'd be expected to probably do a bit of dabbling. Maybe if you could afford the financial risk of the exhibition exhibit. But if you were even going to do any teaching, it would probably be in a school, not an art college. Women students also attended life classes, so they could draw from the model, the life model, but different life classes from the men, so that the model would be draped, partly draped, and they actually had rules about how many layers of fabric there had to be. Fewer layers of fabric for men than women. So Isabel very much sort of broke the mould of the art college. She stood out. She was very tall. She was extremely beautiful. She was very opinionated. She was very athletic. And sort of people have described her as having a sort of a dancing gait and sort of walking into a room with her arms sort of soaring the air, sort of having some sort of great revelation to impart. She's also famous for having sort of a very outrageous laugh. So she stood out and she became involved with another group of art students, boys and girls, who sort of set up a kind of rebel group. And what they did was they set up a breakaway studio. In a sense, they were very inspired by the painter Walter Sickert. And they set up a kind of a studio in a rundown room over the Cabin Club. If any of you know Liverpool, it's still there apparently. They all posed for each other so that everybody could get equal access to the life model. And Isabel became extremely good at drawing for life, and on the basis of her life drawing, she won a scholarship to the Royal Academy in London. But she was very unlucky because this coincided with the Wall Street crash and the beginning of the Depression. It also coincided very tragically with the death of her father. And her mother and her brother were rendered destitute. And I think what would have been normal during this period would be to expect Isabel to sort of pitch in with the family, to get a job in a shop or something like that, and help support her family. But her mother didn't insist on this. Her mother took a job as a housekeeper in Canada and sent Isabel to London. In fact, Isabel absolutely hated the Royal Academy. The Royal Academy was a bit of a posh finishing school at this point. I mean, most of the women there were sort of wealthy women who were gaining an accomplishment, and there wasn't such a serious attitude to art and to work as there had been in Liverpool. She didn't like it, and of course she ran out of money, and so she left, and she sort of put as big a distance as she could between her and the establishment, and she went to the most controversial artist in London at that time, which of course was Jacob Epstein. He was sort of the other extreme. He didn't get on with the Academy people at all, did he? And Epstein was totally fascinated by this woman. She was so independent. She was like him. She had this huge enthusiasm for the Natural History Gallery and the British Museum, you know, much more than any other gallery. She was a little bit like, I don't know if you know his sculpture, Rima, but she was almost like Rima come to life. And he employed her as his studio assistant and his model. And she had a very successful couple of years. She had her first Bond Street show at the age of 20, and every single work sold. She had very good reviews in the papers. A few months later, she had another show where she was compared very favorably with an established artist like Paul Nash. Epstein, she learned the most enormous amount from Epstein. So Epstein taught her about the figure and figure sculptures. Obviously, they shared an enthusiasm for Rodin. The sculptor Rodin was not fashionable at this time, but Epstein and Isabel agreed that he was a really interesting sculptor. Epstein also had, I'm sure you know this, the largest private collection of African and oceanic figures in any private collection in Europe at this time. And so he loved to pontificate about those. So she had an amazing education with him. But at the same time, he learned from her. She encouraged him to paint and to draw. This was not something he'd ever really, got on top of. And you can see in this gallery the landscape watercolors that were painted when they were together in Epping Forest in 1933. So this success was interrupted when Isabel fell pregnant, and Epstein and his wife claimed the little boy Jackie as theirs, and Isabel had no choice but to give the baby up. And in fact, she never told, in order to protect Jackie, she never told him that she was his mother. And in fact, as far as I can tell, she never saw, after she gave birth to the baby, She never actually saw Jackie or Epstein again after that. And there's actually a little sculpture of Jackie by the lifts. I'm sure you know it. And Epstein was convinced, he was called Jackie after Jacob, short for Jacob, after his father. And Epstein was convinced that genetically Jackie was going to be this fantastic artist, you know, because of who his mother and his father were. And in fact, Jackie became a very famous racing driver and sort of helped set up Silverstone and so on in the early days of Grand Prix. So, whenever Epstein made images of Jackie, and he made lots of them, he gave Jackie, and I don't know whether perhaps he had this kind of reaching sort of pose that was very typical of Isabel, and it was makes me very sad when I see that, the sculpture, because the sort of this gap, although Jackie was a very jolly baby, and you can see he was very happy, there's this sort of kind of longing and this gap in these sort of open arms that Epstein always gave him. So go and have a look at that afterwards. So Isabel really had lost everyone she loved, her mother and her brother in Canada. She had lost Epstein, she'd lost her baby. She went to Paris and she carried on her studies, and she worked with the group around Surrealists and Picasso and Balthus, and particularly artists who thought that the future of modern art was not in abstraction, but in the figure. She also shared her commitment to the figure. And her most important relationship that she started then was with the sculptor, another sculptor, interestingly. And you can imagine the conversations that they had, Alberto Giacometti. And I sort of imagine Alberto Giacometti going, well, what was Epstein like then? What were his tricks? What did he do? And it was a very important relationship. They fell in love, and they began a conversation about art and a friendship that went on for 30 years. And they wrote the most fascinating set of letters to each other, which are now in the Tate Gallery. But Isabel's career was interrupted again in 1936 by the advancing Second World War. And she married her partner, who was Sefton Delmer, who was a foreign correspondent, a journalist, and began to do war work. She was couriering money and messages around Europe for 4 years. And so we know this from, this has only recently come to light, we know from her passports that she was in Stresa for the Stresa conference. She was in Spain quite a lot during the Spanish Civil War. She was in Poland. She caught the last plane out of Poland when the Germans invaded Poland. And she left Paris and Giacometti in 1940 in June, just as the Germans were arriving at the city. So Giacometti spent the war working on images of Isabel and memories of Isabel, trying to bring her back in a way. And these became his very famous sort of skeletal figures, which you might know. One of those walking men sold for an enormous amount of money recently. We've got a lot of publicity. Isabel spent the war working for British intelligence just near Bletchley. And after the war, she separated from her husband and went back to Paris and continued to paint, but she was penniless again. No one knew what she'd been doing for the last 10 years. It was a secret. And she hung around with the existentialists, painted in sort of drafty attics, and eventually she returned to London and she took up with Constant Lambert, who was a famous composer, and she'd met him actually when she was with Epstein many years ago. And they were a fantastic team, and they both did fantastic work. She started exhibiting again. She was one of the sort of, you know, the avant-garde artists of London at that time, with people like Lucian Freud and Eduardo Palazzi. Her closest colleague at this time became Francis Bacon. They were very sort of fond of each other for a short time. They were lovers, and they exchanged many ideas. Constant Lambert was also a director of the Royal Ballet, and this is where Isabel became involved with the Royal Ballet. And she collaborated with him on his last project, which was a ballet called Tiresias, which was performed for the Queen and her mother in 1951 for the Festival of Britain. And I only mention this because Isabel designed the ballet and used Epstein's designs for Rima and his Here's a portrait of her, which you might have noticed on the back of the leaflet, as a Minoan goddess. And she used these Minoan costumes for the dancers, which was one of the reasons that the ballet was taken off after 7 performances. And the Duchess of Cornwall apparently left the theatre at half time. But it was a very important and innovative ballet, and it's since been sort of praised and redone and taken seriously. Another tragedy happened that Constant died very unexpectedly a few weeks after the ballet at the age of 46. And Isabel was again left on her own. Their accountant had done them out of all their money, so she was still poor. And she continued to work for the ballet, really just to make ends meet, to do designs for them. And she realised that the ballet provided an opportunity which no knife room, no model that an artist could employ offered. And that was the opportunity to study the model, the body in motion. And this was her sort of major change in her career. This was her sort of statement of independence. Because you might notice that her figures look a little bit like Giacometti's figures. They have a sort of skeletal quality to them, but they're different in that they are moving. Giacometti believed that it was not possible to, in art, in a sculpture or a painting, make an equivalent for the moving body. Whereas Isabel had been reading about the images of dancers by Edgar Degas, painter, 19th century painter, Rodin's drawings and sculptures of moving figures, and she felt that it was possible to take this further, that it was possible to develop the depiction of movement further. And in fact, Francis Bacon was sort of working on a similar tack, and over the next 10 years or so, you know, quite a lot of ideas passed between them. He worked much more quickly, much more decisively. He was, had more talent than her, really. And she actually sort of underwent a much more careful period of research. So she didn't actually even exhibit any of her work until for 5 years. And even then, she didn't exhibit it very much. So many of the drawings in this exhibition have never actually been seen before. She felt that these drawings were just important for her in what they taught her. And she felt an exhibition interrupted that process of learning. She just didn't particularly enjoy exhibiting. She described it as being like walking naked through Piccadilly Circus. So, what I want to do now is sort of think about what exactly Isabel discovered about movement. And to just explain first that this period of research came to an end in 1968 when she exhibited a set of works at what was the leading private gallery in London at that time, the Marlborough Gallery. And in this gallery, the sort of centrepiece was 4 pairs of large, long canvases, which were imitating a set of paintings by Burne Jones that sort of, it's like a scheme of paintings going around a room, a dining room by Burne Jones that she'd seen at Busket Park. And one of these is now in the Tate. Another, a scene from Daphne and Chloe, is in the Royal Opera House. And another, because it was bought by Bacon, is in the Bacon Estate. So I think it's kind of appropriate that this year, the centenary of both Isabel's birth, the pair for the Bayadere should be the centrepiece of this exhibition. Hopefully one day we'll be able to hang them together again. Okay, so let's start off by thinking about these two here. And one of the most important things for Isabel, something that was shared really with her and her colleagues, was that that when you draw the body, you draw it much better if you know the person really, really well, if you're intimate. So although there's lots of figures in these rooms, they are really just a handful of dancers. So for example, here we have Margot Fonteyn. And Isabel was particularly fascinated by the way Margot Fonteyn had this particular way of moving, which was to do, which had a sort of floating effect, which was sort of in a way like Isabel herself. She had sort of a kind of bird-like quality, and Isabel saw her as having sort of affinity of bird, with birds like herself. She, of course, also had a sort of probably a deeper and probably more complicated relationship with Margot Fonteyn, because Margot Fonteyn had also been the long-term lover of Constant Lambert. So they sort of had very similar experiences from that point of view. Isabel has another important aspect of her art is that she always looks at images through other images. So every time you look at one of her images, there's always lots and lots of other images there, sometimes by other people, sometimes by herself. So, for example, when we took this painting here out of the frame, we discovered on the back a whole different painting. And this, we believe, is Rudolf Nureyev, who often danced with Fonteyn. Another dancer that you can see around the room is here. We have Svetlana Beryozova. Svetlana Beryozova is easy to spot because she had this extraordinary neck, a neck like a horse, very muscular neck. And Isabel quite often didn't even bother with her head because it was the musculature of the neck and the movement of the neck that interested her. And she actually sort of wrote down her sort of philosophy about the sort of knowledge of the dancers and the sort of idea of what she called a moving portrait. In other words, it's a portrait, but it's whole body, and the movement itself is also a portrait. When recording dancers, I am, in a sense, making their portraits. They are people and so have emotional implications. I try to understand as much as possible about the individual shapes and gestures. And Isabel also, as well as studying natural history, she also studied anthropology. She's very interested in anthropology. I'm sure you've all heard of Desmond Morris, who was sort of, you know, one of the same circle. And she was a sort of pioneer of what we would now call body language. In other words, the idea that, that the body is a kind of signature, that a particular movement or a particular pose expresses a certain set of emotions or thoughts on the part of an animal or a human being. So ballet, can often be sort of thought of as sort of pretty or sentimental or romantic, but Isabel really didn't approach it like that. She was sort of like Digger. She called ballerinas those who experiment with the body, and she thought of ballet dancers as working bodies. And so she wrote that it's important to be aware of the skeleton beneath the form. Few sights seem to be more mysterious and beautiful than the curve of the spine running from the base of the skull to the arch of the foot. So she sort of understood bodies through their anatomy, through their framework. So if you don't mind, I'm going to sort of get you to stand up, and we're going to go and have a look at this one over here. Thank you. I'll let you sit down again in a minute. You see, if you look at here, this is another image of Fonteyn. This is Fonteyn of Chloe. You can see if we look here that Isabel's skeletons, we can see the skeleton within the body emerging, but they're different from Giacometti's skeletons. You know, they're moving, articulating to skeletons. They're working skeletons. Another aspect of the way Isabel looks at the moving body is to consider the environment, the setting. The idea of not just the figure, but the figure in the room was a really important motif in 20th century literature, if you think about someone like Franz Kafka or Jean-Paul Sartre, and also a very important motif in 20th century art. So if you think about Giacometti or Bacon are very good examples. And in all Isabel's drawings, she includes the lines of the mirrors in the practice rooms, the grid lines on the floor, to calibrate, to sort of measure the dancer's movement against. And this is something that she sort of developed through talking to Frederick Ashton, the choreographer, who understood the importance of there being a limit to the stage or the room for the audience to be able to therefore judge the movement of the dancer. But it goes a little bit further than this, in that Isabel had this sort of idea of wanting to actually place the figure in space, almost so you could sort of see the space surrounding of the dancer. And she was very, very interested in undersea photography because she loved the way that you saw a fish within the medium of the water. She was very, very interested in aquariums. And she thought that the practice rooms, the Royal Ballet practice rooms, where she was drawing with the mirrored walls, were like aquariums. And that's why you sort of get the sort of sense of looking at her dancers as though they're underwater or as though you're looking at them through glass. If we sort of have a look at this one here, we're not sure who the dancer is, but I'm sort of tempted to identify her as Fontaine again, because she has this floating quality, doesn't she? And this is just called Two Dance Positions. And it sort of, I think it sort of highlights perhaps the most important theme of this exhibition, and that is the theme of transience. One of the reasons movement was so important was not just because it brought the figure to life, but because it was fleeting. It only lasted a moment, like real life does. And again, when Isabel was living with Epstein, Epstein's huge hero was the 19th century writer Charles Baudelaire, and Isabel was also, you know, very, very, she owed a great deal to Baudelaire's thought throughout her life. And Baudelaire said that beauty is only true beauty. Nothing can be truly beautiful unless it's about to disappear, unless it's fleeting. And one of Isabel's most important statements, just at this turning point in her career in the 60s, sort of brings this out. She writes, "I'm beginning to understand what pushes me into painting, the love of seeing and the fact that as the chosen subject grows in beauty, so does it become more elusive." Now, after the war, after World War II, I think these Baudelaire's 19th century ideas had a kind of new urgency. You can understand why that would be. And artists developed a new take on this idea of the fleeting. They became very interested in ways to get rid of this sort of period of time that you spend looking at a work of art. They tried to see whether you could make a work of art that would just be like a firework, that would just come onto your consciousness, come to your eyes in a way instantly, and equally instantly dissolve away. So, both Isabel and Francis Bacon sort of developed this in their own ways. So you have this experience of sort of recognizing something all of a sudden, but as soon as you've looked at it for more than a split second, it's gone again, or it's become something else, or it's just become marks and scribbles. And Isabel said, "I would like the object on the canvas to be sudden, as if it had been designed with a breath." And I think we can see that sort of very nicely in this picture here. Right, so I'm going to sort of pop you into this room over here very quickly, if that's all right. Just leave your things here because you're coming straight back. Take a seat if you like. I'll grab one before anyone else does. So the reason I brought you in here is to show you some of her more impromptu drawings. And in this exhibition, we just have a handful of the hundreds and hundreds of drawings that Isabel made during this 20 years between early 1950s and possibly as late as the early 1970s when she was drawing in the practice rooms. And then she would take these drawings back to her studio and she'd use them to help to make paintings such as the ones on the wall here. And that's why when you look at them, you'll notice this footprint on one of them, you'll notice splashes and scuffs, and that's because she was actually using them while she was painting. She was one of those artists who did not have a tidy studio. It's a sort of grand tradition of them. Now, Auguste Rodin had written about the idea of movement, and one of the things he decided was that if you just have one movement in an image, if it's a sculpture or a drawing, you get a sort of frozen effect, you know, like a photograph gives you this frozen effect. And he thought that the way to solve that was to actually, for the figure, to have more than one movement in it at once. And he was sort of managed sort of to do this. Isabel is trying to do this in a much more ambitious way. So she's not just showing a figure walking, which, you know, both Rodin and Giacometti spent their whole career trying to crack that. And so what she did was she taped together drawings that she'd made, some from memory, as well as some done from the actual practice rooms, to help her break down the movement and bring together different movements into one painting. The other aspect of movement that she developed, where she sort of innovated her technique, was with understanding that another way of communicating movement was not just by showing the body moving, but actually the line itself that you used to draw the body with moved. And so she experimented. As you go around, when you have a look afterwards, you'll notice that she's experimenting all kinds of lines. So here, you know, the sort of wonderful kind of very forceful movements of the charcoal here. Or you'll find other drawings which are just sort of done in ballpoint pen. And sort of, as you'll know, when you push a charcoal across a piece of paper, it sort of catches and you've got to be quite, you know, rough with it. Whereas with a ballpoint pen, it almost runs away with you and does its own movement. And she's exploring different kinds of marks and the kind of movement that they suggest. And of course, the reason they suggest a movement is because she's been moving when she made it. And so we get a sense of that, almost a physical sense of that, when we look at the drawings. And so she actually became very, very interested in marks. And I've left my visual aid in the other room. I'll put it back in a minute. Where have I put it here? She became very interested in anything that made a mark. So, for example, the pattern that you might, a linear pattern that you might think you see between stars in the sky, graffiti. She was very interested in graffiti. She became very interested in the blurs that you would get in films. So, for example, this is a French film, experimental filmmaker who sort of blurred dances against bars of music. Can you just take, there's two of those. That I think was one of her inspirations. She became very interested, and the reason I brought this in is because this is an actual book that she used a great deal. She became very interested in the drawings on cave paintings, on walls, and the kind of marks that you might find there. And she also became interested in a new invention at the Royal Ballet, invented in 1955, which is called Benesch notation. And what it was up until this point, the only way you could reproduce a ballet was if you knew someone who danced it and they'd teach it to you. The Benesch notation was the first attempt to find a visual language for movement, and it was not just used in the ballet, it was also used by anthropologists. So I just want to give you an example of it, and I think you'll see that these kind of marks are all these kind of marks, graffiti, cave marks, bars of music that are informing her very experimental mark making that we can see in this room. Finally, she worked out that she sort of became extremely skilled in this, and she began to develop lines that could do more than one thing at once. So, for example, we can see here the way one line is describing the bulge of the thigh, the muscle in the thighs, it lifts the knee, and then it goes sort of turns around, so describes the movement of the dancer. It turns around at the same time, it shows us his stomach and the muscles of the stomach and even the sort of jump, so that one line can express a contour can express the sort of skeletal interior of the dancer, and it can also express the direction and the trajectory of the dancer, and all those things can happen. That's just one line. As you can see, there's many, many lines here. You'll also notice, if you look around the room, that the later work has become much, much more curly. And this is because she understood what sort of other people understood, that dancers understood, that because of the way our joints are attached to each other, and because of the way muscles work, that basically motion is a circular thing. Motions tend to happen in circles. So we can see this again in this extraordinary drawing here. Right, if you want to pop back out, you can sort of sit down again and we'll finish off. Thank you. So we're going to be looking at this one here now. Ideas, and what I'm trying to sort of get across here is the way that this is an artist who, over a very long period of study and a very kind of intense engagement with other works of art, or even just other objects, you know, like a line in the sand, another artist is sort of building up a sort of very kind of complicated, layered kind of visual language. And she brings all these ideas together in what I think is her most revealing statement. She writes, "To see the touching of hand and hip, of hip and thigh, of hip and shoulder, as the dancers revolve around each other, is to feel an immense sympathy for the body, as though by showing us its strength and suppleness, we are called upon to consider it as vulnerable, a fragile being with a brief existence." And I think movement from La Bayadere shows us what she meant. It deals with transience, particularly in terms of its subject matter, as well as its style. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of background about the ballet. The ballet was an extract from a larger Russian ballet, and it was created by Rudolf Nureyev in 1963. It's his first thing he did for the Royal Ballet when he came to London, having defected from Russia. And he created it for himself and Margot Fonteyn. Margot Fonteyn was a great deal older than Nureyev, but he kind of, you know, between them, they sort of created this amazing magic, which has become very famous. So the subject, Bayadere, means temple dancer. And a temple dancer called Nikia has sacrificed herself because she cannot have her lover, because he's a prince and he has to marry another rich woman. So she dances herself to death at his engagement party. And this extract that Nureyev and Fonteyn dance is called The Kingdom of the Shades, and it deals with the part of the ballet on the night before the prince is due to get married, and he dreams that he goes to Nirvana, high up in the Himalayas, and he sees Nikia dancing with the ghosts, dancing with the other shades. And in the ballet itself, it's a very strange effect is created by totally repetitive actions of 35 shades. And we're very lucky to have a piece of film, courtesy of the Royal Opera House, in the other room, and you can see this sort of uncanny effects it creates. I think this is one of the reasons Isabel was so interested in this ballet. You can see that she's done many, many versions of this arabesque pose all through the exhibition. You see it repeated over and over again. She became very interested in it because she was able to see it done 35 times. Now, at the same time, Francis Bacon is actually using stop-motion photography to study the process of movement. Isabel was using the repeated movements of the dancers to do the same thing. So when dancers see this painting, they say, "My God, it's amazing. She's completely understood the whole principle of the arabesque." So, for example, it's very important if you're a dancer that the ankle is parallel with the knee, and that the knees are all lifted to the same level. And this is what dancers notice when they see this painting. So I think it was just a sort of technical reason why Isabel was interested in it. But there's a reason why she's focused on just these three converging shades. And this relates back to her reading of the medieval writer Dante, and who very famously wrote about what hell was like. And he describes the three shades in hell. They're sort of the most sympathetic of the sinners. And if you look very carefully at the painting, you can see these tiny little yellow flicks. And these relate to the tongues of flame that Dante describes as torturing, licking the three shades. And I think one of the very important things that Isabel did as an artist was that she really sort of broke down the barriers between painting and sculpture. And this is also, the choice of the three shades is a very sculptural decision, this idea of the converging threesome. And in fact, Rodin had chosen Dante's three shades to put on the top of his famous Gates of Hell, again, three converging figures, which are actually three Adams, so they sort of stand for mankind. And Giacometti had made his own version of the three converging figures. So Isabel's having a conversation with all these other people. But I think it's also a conversation about people who have died, about loss. In that she's thinking about the way that you remember someone that has died, the predicament of the prince is that he's remembering Nakia that's died, and what that is like, and the way that a memory of someone that's died can be incredibly physical, but at the same time totally elusive. So when you look at this painting, you've got this sort of incredible physicality of this sort of three-dimensional sculpture effect. So you might catch a knee, or a twisting ankle, or a sort of warped foot on point. But at the same time, they never resolve into anything real. It's not real. You only sort of get these little moments, these little glimpses, and then it's gone. And she kind of drew on sculptural, not just sculptural ideas, but sculptural technique to sort of play with the sort of physical reality of the figure and also its ephemerality. And one of the very important things that happened at this time was that she went to Africa. She went to Nigeria and she studied at a Nigerian art school at the first place in Africa where a sort of Nigerian modernist art was being produced. And so she went and studied with them, and from them she learned about embossing and modelling the paint surface and brought that back. So that you almost have here a kind of relief rather than a painting. And of course, again, in the aftermath of World War I, World War II, this wasn't just a sort of an exotic story of a temple dancer. It was an experience that many, many people were having. Of course, Isabel and Fontaine the dancer had experienced the loss of Constance. And both of them were kind of bothered. It wasn't just about losing someone, it was also about the difficulty of moving on to a new relationship and the new relationship being haunted by the old relationship. Isabel called it Constance's unquiet grave. And I think it's interesting that Francis Bacon bought this picture because he too was at this process in a relationship that was haunted by the loss of a previous lover. So, just before I finish, I feel I can't really just finish without just saying something about why this work, and this is a small part of the body of work Isabel produced in her career, why these pictures are only just coming to light. And it's because I think, obviously, we know that there are certain expectations of women artists still, which aren't quite the same as expectations of male artists. But I think it's also to do with the fact that vast chunks of her life were turned into secrets. So her whole period, highly successful period with Epstein, she never talked about it. She changed her name. She never mentioned those exhibitions because out of respect for Jackie. Her relationship with Giacometti is only just really being understood in its full breadth because she always minimized it out of respect for Giacometti's wife, who she loved very much and got on with. I think probably the same goes for Paolozzi, who never talked about Isabel other than as a pretty girl he knew. It's also been, obviously, because so many artists made images of her, Epstein, Picasso, Giacometti, Francis Bacon, Durand, photographers too, that that she has become confused with the model. And in fact, she only ever actually sat for these portraits in the 1930s. Almost every image of Isabel was made either from memory or from photography. So I think these things are sort of combined to sort of obscure her. The final reason is that the name under which she exhibited, Isabel Lambert, sort of kind of become eclipsed by the fact that Francis Bacon's very famous portraits of her were titled under the name of her last husband, Isabel Rawsthorne. So Yale are insisting that the book that I've written about her gives her name, Isabel Rawsthorne, for example. And I think this has been a problem. But the biggest problem is really Isabel's own fault, is that she just didn't exhibit. She didn't like exhibiting. And that's why I think I'm incredibly grateful to Warsaw New Art Gallery that they sort of, they're correcting that now and that they've put this exhibition on. So if anyone's got any questions, I can.
When did she die?
She died just a few weeks before Bacon died, actually, in 1992. She, like Bacon, she had trouble with her eyes, and she'd probably, not completely sure, but we think she probably stopped working about 1985, although a painting was found on her easel at the time of her death. Very beautiful painting, based on a Turner. Yeah.
Did she ever do any sculpture at all?
There's one mention of working on a sculpture. Balthus, she was always desperate for a studio because she wasn't wealthy, and I'm really grateful if anyone can correct me on this, but I'm not aware of any other women artists in the 20th century that were successful that didn't have some sort of private means, and she didn't have private means, so the struggle through her life was to get a space to work, a studio, and she never had a studio. But in 1939, Balthus lent him his studio, and she just went bonkers, and she did some sculpture then. But unfortunately, she finally got her own studio in 1953. And so most of what she did after 1953, we have, unless it was sold, and a few things have been lost and stolen and so on. But almost everything she did before 1953 is yet to be traced, and so the sculptures fit into that category.
Do they have been like plaster or
long tubes? I'm assuming that they might have been clay or plaster. And one of the sculptures was of a car. And she did say that it was only to help her with her drawing. I don't think she ever considered herself seriously as a sculptor, but she just felt it would help her to understand the form better.
Did you say you were writing the book also?
Yeah. Right. It was hopefully it will be coming out next year, yeah.
Do you know when it'll be out?
About a year's time, I think, yes. It was supposed to be out this year, but as you know, these things track on. Partly because I had no idea there would be so much to write about when I started out on this project. I think it's sort of the underdog thing. I'm sort of very interested in artists that have, where their public image has stopped people seeing the work they were doing. And I was very interested in the way she's sort of dismissed as a model, and therefore people literally are not expecting to see her art.
Well, I have to say that we had, because I work here at the gallery, we had a project here where we were doing like a library, weren't they? Remember that travelling library? And people could go and have a go, and basically it was, if you wanted to write a book, who would it be about? The artist would be called you, and then they would put it into a really small book.
Uh-huh.
And I chose her.
Really?
And it was just called The Life of a Hidden Artist. And once I started trying to find things out about her, because I knew, about Jacob and everything, but I was really surprised once I started to find more and more about her. And I just said, I remember saying to Jo, I wish I could write a book about her, or I wish somebody, and she said, why don't you write one then? And I was so glad when she said, that you had at least to be able to read one in proper detail. Well, teacher deserves it.
It was one of these things, the more you find out, the more you realise you don't know, so I'm sort of just going to publish it and hope that other people will write all the other books that need writing about her. Yeah.
I came this morning and one thing that grabbed me going round, to me she's touched the essence of spirituality.
And what makes you say that?
I can't explain in words, but it's there, it speaks.
Well, she was very interested in trying to find an equivalent, not for the object there, but for the way a human being experiences an object there, or even more, you know, poignantly, the way a human being experiences the presence of a human being. And she was trying to understand the entirety of that, not just the sort of... I think it's very interesting to compare her with Lucian Freud, who, you know, equally important, really kind of looked at that sort of physical relationship between you and the object, and didn't actually copy it, did other things to make you feel the object was there, but she actually, I think, tried to bring more into it. You know, she was part of that whole existentialist. She was deeply atheist, but she was very much interested in the philosophy, Bertrand Russell, and existentialism. And so if that might be... I think she'd be quite pleased you said that. Yeah. Well, don't just have a look at these. Do have go and see if you have a look at the Epstein model of Jackie if you don't already know it. Very well, and also the watercolours. Are they still there, the watercolours in that little room?
Which one is it?
There's a little room with the watercolours in it. It had a kind of tank. It had an aquarium in the middle. So it's incredibly appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you.